An Ethiopian schoolgirl called Bira once ate a wall of her house. She didn't want to, but she found that to eat the wall was the only way to stop her thinking about it. One day, Bira couldn't cope anymore. Her throat was scratched raw from the straw and the bricks, and her body riddled with parasites from the soil. In tears, she walked to her local hospital. The psychiatrist who Bira saw in Addis Ababa told her she had obsessive compulsive disorder. Welcome to Leafing Through Science, where we dive into the pages of popular books in the life sciences with the writers who made them happen, from new releases to timeless classics. This week, we have best-selling author and award-winning journalist David Adam. David got his PhD in chemical engineering from Leeds University, but always preferred writing about science to doing it. Indeed, his postgraduate supervisor once complained his thesis read like it was written by a journalist and not an academic. "David," he said, "you have used the word catastrophic 3 times on the first page." After nearly 2 decades as a staff writer and editor at the scientific journal Nature and the Guardian newspaper, David set up as a freelancer in 2019. And we're here today to discuss his first book, The Man Who Couldn't Stop, OCD, and the True Story of a Life Lost in Thought, published in 2014 about obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD, which manages to be both moving and at times painfully funny. David, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you.
We'll be covering a lot of ground from the strange thoughts that live within us all and David's own harrowing journey with OCD to the treatments available and the potential causes, such as pandas. And no, I don't mean the cute cuddly bears. So let's get into it. It affects about 1.2% of the population, and the World Health Organization lists anxiety disorders, including OCD, as the 6th largest contributor to non-fatal health loss globally. So I think it'd be useful to start off by defining what OCD is. And on the website of OCD UK, a charity you mentioned in your book that works for children and adults affected by OCD, they say OCD is a serious anxiety-related condition where a person experiences frequent, intrusive, and unwelcome obsessional thoughts, commonly referred to as obsessions. Obsessions are very distressing and result in a person carrying out repetitive behaviors or rituals in order to prevent a perceived harm or worry. Such behaviors are known as compulsions. And if a person is suffering with OCD, then it will be impacting on some or all aspects of their daily life, sometimes for hours at a time, each and every day. So, David, is there anything else you'd like to add to that description of OCD?
No, I think that's a very good description. I hadn't heard that before. I guess the only thing I would say is that of the three letters, O, C, and D, it is D which is the most significant. I think everybody can and does have a little bit of O and a little bit of C. You know, we all have some what feel like obsessional thoughts. We all have some ritualistic behavior. But it's only when those two combine to the extent, and I think as that definition mentioned, the paralyzing amount of time that it takes people, that you really get this impact on someone's quality of life, which is the D.
Right. And can you give us some examples of what might be the most common themes of obsessions?
So I like to say that the themes of obsessions are limited only by the human imagination. You know, I've met people who, I met one girl who thought that when she closed her eyes, the whole world would change around her. You know, that she would open her eyes to find a completely alien landscape. And despite the fact that she had a lot of evidence that wasn't going to happen, each time she opened her eyes, the world remained the same. It didn't take away the anxiety that that would happen the next time. I think in terms of themes, I think a lot of it does revolve around sort of a fear of germs, I guess is one. So there's a sense of cleaning and hygiene. So not all the stereotypes about people washing their hands are wrong. OCD can show itself in that way, but often not for the reasons that people might think. And then there are other, I guess, trends. People sometimes like symmetry. They like things to be in a particular way. But again, not because they're neat freaks, just because it is a compulsive response to a disabling thought. But I guess the compulsions tend to group together a little bit more because those are more limited by what we are able to physically do. So checking and seeking reassurance. And there is a certain degree of like order. So you might do things in a particular way until you feel as if you've done it correctly. So yeah, but I think however much all these experiences have in common, almost what unites them is that each time the individual thinks that surely they are the only person who could ever be experiencing the world in this way.
You mentioned a fascinating study done in the 1970s by the psychologists Stanley Rachman and Padmal De Silva, which shows that everyone experiences intrusive thoughts.
Yeah, so I actually met Stanley Rachman when I was researching the book. He's dead now, but I spoke to him about this, and I said that eventually, in my own story, I went to get therapy, and one of the things they do in therapy is they give you a list of these really weird thoughts, like, I want to have sex with my neighbor's rabbit was one of them that stands out, not unreasonably. And then kind of the punchline is that they tell you that these thoughts are all collected from the normal population, the standard population. And this is completely key because one of the reasons I think that OCD is so difficult to treat is because we genuinely believe that we are the only people in the world who could be thinking these things because they're so weird, and partly because people don't talk about them.
Yeah. And so in that study then, if I'm right, the psychologists wrote down these weird thoughts harvested from both OCD patients and healthy people. And then they wrote these down on index cards, mixed the cards up. And even their most experienced clinical colleagues couldn't actually differentiate which thoughts came from patients with OCD and which thoughts came from healthy people.
Yeah, exactly. And it demonstrates a really important principle that these thoughts, as weird as they are part of the normal human experience. And actually, it is the way that people interpret the thoughts and deal with the thoughts or not, which can cause the problems rather than the thoughts themselves, because plenty of people experience these kind of thoughts and don't go on to develop OCD.
That reminds me of a quote attributed to the Stoic philosopher Epictetus. It is not things that disturb us, but our view of those things. Because if almost everybody experiences intrusive thoughts, and intrusive thoughts are the raw materials for obsessions, then we have to ask ourselves why almost everybody doesn't develop OCD.
Yeah, so some of this is hypothetical, because we don't actually know is the honest answer about why some people develop OCD and others don't. And our views of that are filtered through the way that science is clustering at the time. So, you know, if you ask a geneticist, they will say it's all not all in the genes, but the genetic component's important. If you ask a behavioral psychologist, then it could be down to learned responses. If you ask a cognitive psychologist, it's much more to do with these ideas about thoughts and how we respond to them. You know, the advent of MRI allowed us to then look at scans in the brain, and then led to the idea that, you know, neurologists will talk about particular regions of the brain. And then we started looking at circuitry within the brain, how those regions communicate. And now that's believed to be one of the reasons. The honest answer is that we don't know. But in terms of the cognitive psychology route, certainly one of the ideas is that there are personality types which are more likely to turn those intrusive thoughts into OCD. One of which is people just, they place too much importance on thoughts. And it can come down to what we already think of as important. So, for example, two people are sat in a church and there's a picture of the, or a statue of the Virgin Mary. And they both have the same thought about having sex with the Virgin Mary, but one of them is an atheist. That's not going to bother that person. They might think that's weird, but they're very, very unlikely to respond to it in a way that would lead to OCD. Whereas someone who is deeply religious would find that thought so personally offensive that they would respond to it in some way and they would react to it. And so it's not always just the nature of the thought. It's about whether that clashes with the kind of people that we like to think that we are.
So what makes these thoughts so distressing for someone with OCD is that they, I guess, clash with their values or desires and go against their very beliefs and sense of self.
That's exactly it, yeah. So, I mean, I'll give you a common example would be when people are around children, sometimes they get a thought of harming a child. Now, the only person you need to worry about harming a child when they have that thought is the person who doesn't think it's odd. You know, or new parents experience this all the time, intrusive thoughts around harming their baby. And we don't quite understand the full mechanism why that might be, but we do know that if people recognize that thought as weird and horrible and repulsive and they would reject it and they would never act on it, then it doesn't say anything at all about their motives and what they want to do and how they will behave.
And in the book, you mentioned that Winston Churchill, the British wartime leader during World War II, was afraid of sea travel because of his ego-dystonic urge to jump into the water.
Yeah, so ego-dystonic is sort of the psychological jargon for clashes with who we are. And the reason Churchill's thoughts were ego-dystonic was because he was having thoughts of suicide and he wasn't suicidal. He had also had thoughts about leaping from balconies and he would have to stand behind a pillar when the express train came through the railway station because he got the similar urges, but he didn't want to kill himself. He just got these urges to act in that way, which he found very puzzling, as I think anybody would.
And crucially, one of the things that sets OCD apart from other conditions involving intrusive thoughts is that the person at some level knows the thoughts, fears, or feelings that are causing them distress are irrational and wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Because to complete the logic, what happens then is you fight against it. So you reject the thoughts. When someone will say to you, don't think about it, you know, you can try and suppress the thought, but actually there's some evidence that trying not to think about a thought makes you think about it more, which has a bit of logic to it.
You talk about the white bear game that the Russian novelist Leo Tolstoy would play as a child, where he had to stand in one corner of a room and try not to think of a polar bear. And of course, he couldn't think of anything else. And this has since become known as the white bear phenomenon and was later picked up by the American psychologist Daniel Wegner in a beautiful study which shows how thought suppression often backfires.
So, yeah, it's exactly what we were talking about. If we say to listeners now, you know, don't think of an elephant, you can't not think of something without scanning to see if you are thinking of it. And so, yeah, so the white bear experiment was a way, I guess, of one of those experimental psychology studies which sort of proves what or tries to prove, gathers data to try and prove something which we know to be, through our own experience, to be correct, that you cannot suppress a thought, and in fact doing so could make the thought more likely to come back. And I think people would recognize that from all sorts of behaviors that we try to avoid, like people who are trying not to eat chocolate cake, probably can't think of anything except chocolate cake. People who are trying to give up smoking, you know, they that craving for a cigarette just gets stronger and stronger. The more they try not to think about it, the harder it gets.
And so overimportance of thoughts and the need to control them may be one such door through which OCD can enter. But there are other kind of dysfunctional beliefs that can also open the door for OCD, and maybe you can talk to us about some of those.
I think the other personality type that people have identified is sort of a sense of inflated responsibility, you know, or an inflated sense of responsibility, where we basically take responsibility for things for which we are not responsible. This is something which people, even without OCD, will be able to identify with. Let's say people, all, it doesn't have to be OCD, all the time get fears about whether they left the gas on or whether they left the iron on, whether they left the fire on, okay? And that's because you don't want to burn the house down, clearly. But how many people get those same thoughts about whether their partner did those things? And in actually, in my case, my partner's much more likely to do all of those things. And yet I don't worry about that. I don't call her and say, did you turn the iron off? Because it would be her fault if she burnt the house down, not mine. And I think it's when it's their own fault that it causes them to become conscious of this as an idea and to take some kind of steps to try and reduce that risk of it happening.
Right. And you give some examples of this inflated responsibility and how it can play out in people with OCD. The remarkable case of patient zero, as you describe her for OCD, a young French woman from the early 19th century known as Mademoiselle F, who was tormented by the fear that she might have unknowingly stolen something. And to alleviate this anxiety, she performed these intricate rituals, repeatedly inspecting her body, shoes, and every article of clothing for any object of value that could have somehow been transferred to her. And interestingly, her renowned psychiatrist, Esquiol, writes that she was never irrational, is aware of her condition, perceives the ridiculous nature of her apprehensions and the absurdity of her precautions, and weeps at and makes sport of them. Again, that alluding to what we talked about earlier about how people with OCD are very much aware of the irrationality of these thoughts. And I guess there are some other ways of thinking that, that, again, might open the door for OCD, the overestimation of threat and the belief that things are riskier than they are. You talk about how the understanding of statistics in OCD can be a bit like Jim Carrey's character in the film Dumb and Dumber. A woman tells him the odds of her agreeing to join him on a date are 1 in 1,000,000, and he replies, "So you're telling me there's a chance?" So, David, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your own journey with OCD, and maybe we can start at the beginning. You know, how did OCD begin for you?
Yeah, so OCD began for me when I was about 19. So I grew up in the 80s. Not unusually at the time, my OCD revolves around the fear of HIV and AIDS, as it was then. You know, in the late 80s, it was this great unknown. And the only weapon that people had to try and curb the spread of what they thought could be this huge plague was to frighten people into changing their behavior. And so there were these terrible adverts, on, and they're on YouTube if you want to go and see them, basically scaring people about having sex. And I developed intrusive thoughts about HIV, even though I hadn't done anything that would make me put me at risk. And I'd found that in all the ways that we've talked about, I recognized these thoughts as alien and weird, but I couldn't make them go away. So instead of trying to make them go away, I tried to respond to them in a way that would reassure me. So I would go for, I had tests for HIV. I would call people and ask, can you catch HIV in this way and that way? And all of which we now know was feeding these intrusive, irrational thoughts about ways that I could catch it.
And we were talking about compulsions, one of the compulsions being seeking reassurance. And so you just mentioned there that you would call up the AIDS helpline and try and get reassurance that you hadn't contracted the virus.
So yeah, I would call them up and I'd sort of detail this intrusive thought. Let's say I've been playing football on AstroTurf back in the day. It was like sandpaper, and if you fell over on it, you would really cut your knee. And I'd start to think that maybe someone else could have done that at the exact same spot. They could have left some HIV-infected blood there. It could have got into my blood system. So, you know, in theory, and I would call the National AIDS Helpline. They would say, nothing to worry about. You know, the risk of that kind of transmission is very low. And I would get that little hit of reassurance, and I'd think, great. But then almost immediately after I hung up the phone, I'd think, well, they said it was very low, not zero, the risk. So maybe there is a risk. I didn't explain it properly, so I'd call them back. In each case, I knew what they were going to say, but I wanted them to say it because I thought this will be the time that reassures me. This is the time that it will land and make a difference, because I knew the answer, and yet telling it to myself wasn't helping. So I thought, I'll get someone else to say it to me. And it did help for a brief moment, but then again, because of what we've talked about, the cycle, you're just reinforcing the cycle. And in fact, I called them so often, they would start to recognize my voice, and they start to say, well, no, we've already spoken, I've already told you, you know, this information, you need to go away and accept it, which is not what I wanted. I wanted the hit of reassurance. So I'd call back and I'd disguise my voice. You know, I'd put on different accent to get them to tell me that everything was going to be okay.
You also write quite movingly, OCD stole something from me at that stage of my life. It took away my attention, and how OCD thoughts in the days leading up to your marriage, for example, kind of took grip and focused your attention away from where you wanted it to be.
Yeah, it's when we talked about the D in OCD, you know, I forget the exact threshold, but it's hours and hours a day that someone has to spend, and you really feel like you're deceiving people, I suppose, and you're deceiving yourself. But most of all, you just can't stop thinking about things that are really frightening.
Yeah, and you write that obsession meant that I navigated much of life after the summer of 1991 on autopilot. I was upfront and central. I looked the part and smiled at the passengers, but something else was flying the plane.
Yeah, and flying it round in circles.
And you also talk about how OCD dulled your emotions, except for the moments when your football club, Stoke City, scored a goal.
Yeah, it's tragic, isn't it? It's about distraction again. It's about those moments in life where, I think sports people call it flow. You know, you genuinely only think about one thing. It's very, very unusual. Usually we have these parallel narratives going on in our head all the time. Even people without OCD will be familiar with that. You know, they're focusing on one thing while they're thinking of something else. It's just that in my case, that parallel narrative was the same for years and years and years and years. But there were certain moments, certain activities where there was only room for one thought at that time, and it wasn't OCD, it wasn't HIV, and that was just brilliant. And one of the few times that happened was, yeah, you go and watch a football match, and that split second when your team scores a goal, there's just that pure release of happiness for however long it lasts. And another one was skiing, weirdly. I just found that when I skied, the only thing I thought about was staying upright, or, you know, or the mechanics of it, where to turn, what to do, how to move. And weirdly, public speaking. You know, I've got no issue with public speaking at all, because I used to relish it, because I wasn't thinking of HIV when I was doing a public speaking. It, even as kind of stressful as people find it, it was that stress that forced those thoughts of HIV out of my head. But you try and live a life around public speaking, skiing, and watching Stoke City score goals, and you have a lot of time left over, I think.
Well, as you say, when you rely on goals from Stoke City to get you through life, you know you truly are screwed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So do you remember the day that you finally decided to seek treatment?
Yeah, I mean, of course I do, because it was, I guess it was me hitting the bottom in a way, and it was years and years later, and I had a baby daughter, and I found myself involving her in some of the rituals that I was doing and the thoughts that I was doing, because entirely as you would expect with OCD, it leaks into other parts of your life and other people in your life. And I found myself worrying on her behalf about HIV and AIDS. And there was this one particular day where we were playing in the playground, and I noticed she had blood on her, what looked like blood on her leg. And I mean, she wasn't even crawling at this stage, so it had to come from me. And sure enough, I had a little scratch on my hand, and I thought, well, obviously, when I've lifted her in and out of the swing, my blood's just got on her leg. And then the intrusive thought came that actually, well, maybe it's not my blood, maybe it's someone else's blood, maybe she's rubbed it into her eyes. And I thought, well, I'll do the reassurance seeking. I'll make sure there is no blood on the swing and around where she was standing. And I checked, and of course there wasn't. And I thought, well, I'll put her into the swing again to see where she touches, what she grabs hold of, and I'll check those areas especially carefully. I must have put it in and out of the swing about 10 times, and part of me, just the big part of me, just said, what on earth are you doing? What on earth are you doing? Because I'd kind of come to terms with the fact that OCD was going to screw up my life, but there was nothing, I was never ever going to do anything that would make it more likely for her to copy me or develop it or any of that. And so, yeah, so I rang the doctors the next morning, rang the GP the next morning, and that was the start of me getting the treatment.
And so eventually you started cognitive behavioral therapy, which is based on the idea of exposure and response prevention. And could you tell us, just give us an insight into what those group therapy sessions involved and how they worked for you?
Yeah, so this was after I went to the doctor, I got into the system, and on the UK's national health provision, I got offered two things. I was given sertraline, the SSRI drug, a bit like Prozac, which I still take, and CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, in a group, because that way they could just see more people. And yeah, I had about 6 or 8 sessions, weekly sessions, I think, of about 3 hours. And they were all, there was about maybe 10 of us, all with OCD, some of whom similar kind of thoughts about HIV. And we would discuss, so cognitive behavioral means, cognitive is you learn about the theory of the thoughts and the fact that everybody has them, and it's how we respond to them that's the problem. So we kind of recognized a bit of that. And then the behavior, which was essentially a help to not perform the compulsions, because compulsions, they fuel the obsessions in that destructive cycle. So exposure just means you trigger the obsession, which in my case was very easy. It was happening all the time anyway. But the response prevention is key, because you then take away the shortcut for that person to reduce the anxiety. So the anxiety stays high. And for as long as you don't perform the compulsion, the anxiety stays high. But the anxiety just cannot stay high forever. It's impossible. And so the longer you go without performing the compulsion, the greater the chance you are encouraging of that anxiety just starting to go away by itself. It's what they call extinction decay. And the theory is that once we experience that anxiety going away by itself, we have more confidence not to perform the compulsion the next time. So if we know we can reduce the anxiety just by letting the thought sit there, however hard it is at the time, and it's really hard, knowing that the anxiety will ebb and fade by itself, knowing that we're going to get to feel better without performing the compulsion, in theory, stops people performing the compulsion, and it breaks that cycle between the obsessions and the compulsions.
Yeah, and I struggled with OCD some years ago, and I bought a book on cognitive behavioral therapy. And one of the exercises I remember doing and working quite well for me was to write down the thoughts, the obsessions, on paper. And something about that exercise actually robbed them of the power they had over me.
Yeah, I think whatever it is, you know, whatever it is that people find, I think they describe it as sort of the helicopter view. It's that idea that you see everything's in their true proportion from above.
And what's fascinating is often obsessions that may have plagued the mind for 30 years or more can be tamed by several hours of exposure and response prevention therapy. It goes to show that the brain is actually quite malleable. And I think successful therapy even shows up on brain scans. It's a good illustration of how the thoughts you have are directly related to the structure of the underlying brain tissue. The mind is the brain.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, you can see the impact of thoughts, you know, on the structure of the brain, or at least using different parts of the brain in that way.
And there's a really harrowing section of your book where you talk about how in the mid-20th century, tens of thousands of people with OCD and other mental illnesses had their brains irreversibly damaged by cavalier surgeons armed, as you put it, with nothing more precise than knitting needles. And this procedure was known as a lobotomy, a procedure developed by the Portuguese neurosurgeon Iguez Muniz. I think it was once described as burning down a house to roast a pig.
Yeah, it's extraordinary now, but you know, in the exact time period, 40s, 50s, it was seen as this great hope, and a lot of people had it done, not always willingly, or at least not always with the full kind of consent or knowledge about what was going to happen. And in some cases it did help, but then in plenty of cases it just took her condition, which we now know to be treatable to an extent in most people, and made things an awful lot worse.
Yeah, and surprisingly, so these lobotomies often had severe side effects in patients, including personality changes, cognitive impairments, but it didn't stop Iguez Muniz from getting the Nobel Prize for developing the lobotomy in 1949. And ironically, he wasn't able to travel to accept his Nobel Prize, as by then one of his patients had shot and paralyzed him.
Yeah. Not a great advert.
Not a great advert, no. And since I promised to talk about pandas at the start of the show, in your book you mentioned that in 1998, researchers found evidence to suggest that in children, OCD may sometimes be triggered by strep throat infections, a condition known by the acronym PANDAS. And the idea is that the body's immune response could produce antibodies that then mistakenly affect the basal ganglia, a brain region implicated in OCD. And I'll take this opportunity to give a shameless plug to our neuropsychiatry unit here at the Champalimo Foundation, led by Albino Oliveira Maia, because a researcher there, Ana Maia, is currently looking into both childhood trauma and infection history, including exposure to streptococcus as potential causes of OCD. So stay tuned for that. And also the unit is exploring an interesting new treatment for OCD that's emerged since you wrote the book, transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS for short. And this is a non-invasive treatment that uses magnetic fields to change brain activity. And for those interested in learning more about that project at the foundation, we'll include a link in the show notes to the lab and an interview with Gonzalo Cotovio, who's leading this particular line of research. Now, psychiatry still relies heavily on self-reported symptoms to make a diagnosis. And that's because finding reliable biological differences in people with mental illnesses has so far proved elusive. And in recent years, you talk in your book about there being a shift in psychiatry away from diagnostic categories, as outlined in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, commonly referred to as the Bible of psychiatrists, because people are now thinking that these diagnostic categories probably don't carve nature at the joints, and are starting to view OCD and other mental illnesses as a spectrum of symptoms rather than as a single condition. And the idea behind this approach is that it helps to tailor treatments to specific symptoms rather than using a one-size-fits-all method. And could you just talk to us a bit about this newer dimensional approach to OCD and this idea that there may be a continuum between mental illnesses and healthy individuals?
I think anybody who worked in psychiatry has always known that they always say the patients haven't read the manual. You know, the patients don't turn up with symptoms that are neatly divided by different conditions. Now that is done, it's done for good reason. You know, we have to have diagnoses if we're going to try and treat people, for example, to decide who gets drugs, who doesn't. We have to try and decide who is most severe, to prioritize who gets treatment. But that none of that actually seems to map onto the way that people experience these conditions. And so the dimensional approach is an attempt to, I guess, to say, right, imagine we didn't have to categorize people in this way. Actually, what would be the starting point? And it could be that you would look at what conditions have in common rather than what sets them apart. So you would bundle certain conditions together based on disorders of thought. And so this is kind of the dimensional idea, meaning that there aren't hard and impermeable divisions between mental disorders. There is this continuum. And indeed, the continuum operates in both directions. So you can have a degree of severity. You know, there is a cutoff point, the O, C combined to make the D, but it's entirely possible for someone to have a far more severe case of OCD than somebody else, just as it is for depression or for any other mental illness.
Just thinking of wrapping up now, so what would you like to say to the people who are affected by intrusive thoughts and who think they may have OCD?
I learned to my cost that OCD does not go away by itself. It's a medical issue. It needs expert medical help. Now, I know not everybody can access that help, but unfortunately, medical help, expert help, is really the only way to reliably treat this. But it can be treated. It really can. In a sense, there has never been a better time to be born with OCD than now. You know, as we've talked about, 200 years ago, people thought you would be possessed by evil spirits. You know, 100 years ago, Freudian analysts would have talked to you about your mum, and 50, 60 years ago, you'd have been given a lobotomy, and so on and so on. So at least now we are at the stage where we have evidence-based treatments that mostly work for most people. And the real challenge now is accessing it rather than working out what we need to do with these people.
Any useful resources for people? You mentioned in your book the charity OCD UK, for example.
Yes, yeah, so obviously I'm in the UK. That's the one I'm most familiar with. There's an international OCD foundation, which is based in the States, but I think helps people everywhere. There's loads of books. You know, my book is not a self-help book. It's just designed to sort of give people a story, really, of OCD. But there are self-help books out there. If there's loads of resources, just to sort of a Google search away.
And how can people get in touch with you, David?
I guess email. I am on Twitter, but I very rarely use it. But you can email me. My email address is on my website.
And finally, a book, fiction or non-fiction, that you might like to recommend to listeners?
Oh, wow. that's embarrassing. I'm trying to think what I've read recently that I like. I tend to read old stuff. Oh, I've got one. Okay. I actually got it here in front of me. This, my mother-in-law gave me this, which I recommend.
The Wager.
I really do recommend. Yeah.
A Tale of Shipwreck, Mutiny and Murder by David Gran.
And it's non-fiction. It sounds like fiction, but it isn't. It's good.
Excellent. Oh, and you did write in your book, as I write this book in 2013, Stoke City is a football club that plays in the English Premier League. As you read it, I hope it still does. Is Stoke City still in the Premier League? No. All right.
maybe one day again soon.
Okay, great. Well, David, listen, thank you so much for taking the time today to chat with us about your book. I really, really enjoyed it, and I strongly recommend that people read it too. We'll be including links to the things we've discussed in the show notes. And for now, for me, that's it.
Great. Thank you.